I've seen instances where I came in and I had been working at that one company probably for about 8 years. And I was in the same position every time I interviewed for something better. It never came about. And there was a young girl that came in that probably had a year in college and dropped out. And she came in and I trained her and she ended up being my boss. And she was white, you know, and I actually had my degree from college and I had that solid work history under my wing. And I was never considered for a job.
And real-world politics. I'm Martin R. Schneider.
And I'm Marga Rustic.
And the voice that you just heard is Carla Baptiste. Carla is currently the Career Center Manager of the Urban League of Philadelphia. And we're going to hear a little bit more from her in a bit. But the reason we started off with her is because this new episode that we're recording right now is about the intersection of race and gender. This is part of our ongoing series on films and TV depicting women in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. And this is unfortunately a very, very, very common narrative in the lives of people who aren't white and privileged.
Now, that's a good lead-in. Disclaimer, we are white.
Like, really white.
So what the information that we're sharing right now is things that we've heard secondhand, or since we're a show about pop culture, what we've seen depicted in TV and film. We'll hear from Carla a little bit later where she talks about the way that people of color and women of color are depicted in the media. Mm-hmm. So, as a disclaimer, we're presenting things secondhand.
As two Caucasian cisgender individuals.
Yeah. Hopefully we won't, but we might get something wrong. And if we do get something wrong,
we want to hear about it.
Please feel free to call us out. You can email us, politicaltheaterpodcast@gmail.com. Tweet at us, @polytheatercast. If there's something that you think we should correct course on, or if there's a piece of film or TV that we didn't get into, let us know.
But the whole point of this podcast was not only to discuss how we feel about pop culture and different themes in it, but we want to start a dialogue with you. So if you feel moved to, definitely let us know what you're thinking.
Also, you can rate, review, iTunes, Stitcher, all of the above, etc. You know the drill. You've listened to podcasts before. Let's get into what we actually want to get into. So last time on the show, we talked a little bit about the wage gap. And we mentioned that it is worse for women of color.
Mm-hmm. And just for people who might not understand what that term means, how would you define women of color? Anybody who's not white? Is there anything else that goes along with that?
I mean, basically, anybody who is not Caucasian. Anyone who is Hispanic, African American, Native American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander.
So if you're not of European descent.
To put it in like racially crude terms, the paper bag test, which is any shade of skin that is darker than a paper bag.
Wow. Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard that one before.
Never heard of a paper bag
test? That is how oblivious I am to.
No, that's how in tune to internet racists I am.
Oh.
When you have a Jewish last name, you become very aware of internet racism.
I mean, I'm accustomed to internet sexism, which is in the same vein, but it's definitely different. But
And that's actually a good lead-in for what we're talking about today. And what we're discussing is intersectionality,
mm-hmm.
Which has a couple of different definitions. And for the most technical research-based definition, once again, we're going to turn to Whitney Carroll.
Your socioeconomic background, your own personal ethics, the way that you're raised, the school that you went to, all those different things make up how you perceive things and how you take things. So, you know, and just the experience of, you know, in higher education specifically, they call it the white privileged male. So what was typically up until, you know, maybe the last 20 years, the majority of people that worked in the higher level positions were white privileged males. They were the ones that were educated. That's what higher education was made for in the early 1900s. And so they have one specific viewpoint on what goes on in the workplace. as opposed to maybe an African-American female who not only experiences sexism from a women's point of view, but also experiences racial prejudice and microaggression. So coming from that background, I think you have two very different perceptions and two very different experiences. So one terminology that we use a lot in gender research, and I know you've mentioned this just in the topic for the week, is intersectionality. So every person, and that's essentially more qualitative research theory that says that every single person is impacted by the different lived experiences that they've had. And so every person experiences things differently. So a lot of what we have to look at is the intersectionality of someone's, their sexual orientation, how they were raised, what their viewpoints are, their politics, their religion, all of those things influence us. But the media is particularly something that I think creates a more controversial and more negative impact on some of these things.
So that's one definition of intersectionality. Another way to look at it comes from civil rights advocate Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, basically describing intersectionality. It basically is your social identity and then related systems of oppression, domination, discrimination, anything that keeps you from being able to advance. How does your identity contribute to those biases?
Essentially, you have a certain level of oppression and discrimination as a woman, and you also have a certain level of oppression and discrimination as a black person.
Yeah.
But if you are a black woman, and maybe if you're a gay black woman or a transgender black woman, it piles on.
Yeah.
So you're at a double disadvantage when it comes to social mobility.
Yeah.
So that's what we're looking at right now. So as part of our series on women, we're talking about films and TV, very recent films and TV, depicting women of color, specifically. Yeah.
So in that vein, the first movie we're going to look at was a massive hit from the end of 2016, early 2017, Hidden Figures. And I loved this movie. There were so many moments in it where you really cheered for the characters, and it does a great job of looking at how limiting opportunities were for qualified women who were African-American during the beginnings of the space race.
And it also gets into something that we touched on a little bit in our last episode, which is the presence of women in STEM fields. And it highlights that originally, these fields that we think of as highly male-dominated and high-paying jobs, things like coding and computing and programming, those were seen as basically women's work. They were seen as like small menial tasks. Not to say that women's work is menial tasks, but you know what I'm saying.
It was what it was looked upon men.
Right. And as men got more interested in it, that's when the salary went up and
started to drive women away.
And Hidden Figures addresses that when they talk about the IBM computer that gets installed in the NASA base. So let's back up a little bit. In case you didn't see Hidden Figures last year, it was directed by Theodore Melfi. It was written by Theodore Melfi and Alison Schroeder, who previously didn't have a whole lot of writing credits to her name.
Now she's making a movie about Christopher Robin.
Yeah, now she's got a big name with a big deal with Disney. But like the biggest thing she had done beforehand was Mean Girls 2.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even know there was a Mean Girls 2.
Yeah, I think it was direct-to-video.
Oh. Okay.
So, I mean, props for giving Alison Schroeder an opportunity.
Yeah.
We'll say that the writing is probably the weakest part of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say that? Because it's just so PG?
There's nothing wrong with being a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm. Like, it hits all these notes that you know it's going to hit. You've seen this movie a dozen times. But it does hit them very well. But I think the majority of that is performance.
Yeah.
So
I'll cop to that.
Yeah, I'm not gonna like bash on it too much because it is a good movie, and I don't think there's anything wrong with pleasing a crowd.
Mm-hmm. And we needed this movie so badly at the end of last year too.
This is true. So yeah. The film stars Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, and Janelle Monáe.
Love her.
Who is our goddess? Mm-hmm. Our robot queen, and they play programmers, computers. They were like literally their job was computers because they were there to compute numbers
and calculations
for NASA during the space race during the Apollo launch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they worked on the first launch where they put John Glenn into orbit around the Earth.
Right. So they're on the Apollo 11 mission?
Well, no. Apollo 11 is what brought Neil Armstrong and company.
Okay,
I'm embarrassed as an American that I don't know who the other guys were.
Buzz Aldrin.
Yes.
And the guy that no one remembers because he didn't actually get to go on the moon.
Sorry.
We're not going to Wikipedia you.
Yeah.
but, okay, so, sorry. This is... They're doing Mercury 7.
Yeah.
So they're going in orbit. They haven't reached the moon yet.
Right.
So, but these were the women who designed original computations, kind of designed the flight patterns that put John Glenn into orbit.
Yes.
John Glenn, by the way, is a small part of this, but he definitely gets the, like, white guy hero treatment all throughout. Like, the women just kind of, like, comment on how hot he is, and they're like...
And he's nicer to them than everybody else is.
He is. Now, I mean, it's very wrong to say that John Glenn isn't an American hero.
Right.
But this gets, like, to the point of, like, hagiography. Mm. Like, they are filleting him, essentially.
Oh, jeez.
I
needed that image in my head right now.
Other people in this movie, it's got a great cast.
It does. Kirsten Dunst. It's got a...
Kirsten Dunst is playing against a... She's so good in this.
Mm-hmm.
Playing like the white middle manager, bless your heart, kind of like not direct racist.
Yeah.
But
she doesn't think she's racist, but she's clearly racist.
And one of the best scenes of the movie is Octavia Spencer calling her out on that.
Yeah.
Kevin Costner playing like America's dad, mm-hmm. as he normally does.
Jim Parsons
is such an interesting call in this. Jim Parsons of Big Bang Theory fame. Because he is essentially the gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's what is keeping Taraji P. Henson's character, Katherine Johnson, from getting the credit that she deserves.
Yeah.
There's a line in the song, 9 to 5, where we talked about it last week, where they use your mind and never give you credit. And there's a huge subplot where Katherine Johnson, played by Taraji, is trying to get her name on the work that she does.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Parsons is standing in her way and taking the credit, literally putting his name on it.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that they cast Jim Parsons because the, like, racist gatekeeper here isn't, like, a super bro-y guy.
Yeah.
It's not, like, a dude in a frat boy hat,
It's a nerd.
Yeah, it's a nerd.
And you would think that nerds would be nice to everybody because they get shat upon by everybody else, but not in this movie.
But no, because he's in nerd world. Yeah. Like, in his world, he's the king.
Mm-hmm.
You know, compare that to... I just saw The Big Sick over the weekend.
Yeah.
Which has a scene where a racist gets called out, but that racist, like, they go out of their way to make him look like a frat boy douchey racist.
Okay.
I don't know, there's just an intersectionality of shittiness, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then supporting roles from Mahershala Ali, who is wonderful. He won the Oscar for this role, I believe.
He won for Moonlight. He deserved it for Moonlight. He was cute in this, but Moonlight was where it was at.
Yeah, he won for Moonlight. God, he had a huge year last year.
Oh, yeah.
He also, like, stole every scene he was in Luke Cage. Rounding out the cast is Aldous Hodge from TV's Leverage and two episodes of Friday Night Lights. There's a lot of good moments in this, and there's a lot of moments that are also, like, super white savior-y.
Oh, God. Well, that scene we were talking about before we started recording where Katherine Johnson is basically soaking wet, and her boss is like, you know, whenever I need you, you're not at your desk. What's going on? And she basically says... There's no bathroom for me here. I have to, you know, run 3/4 of a mile each way to relieve myself, and it's because y'all don't want to use the same bathroom as me. Y'all don't even use the same coffee maker as me because I'm black. That was a great scene, but, you know, the next scene you see Kevin Costner, her boss, taking a crowbar to the sign that says white bathroom, basically saying, this bathroom is for everybody. And my question is, why couldn't it have been one of the, you know, the women in the office saying, you know, this isn't right that they have to run all the way across campus to use the bathroom. They should just have it here.
It could have been like Kirsten Dunst's redemption moment, mm-hmm. I guess. But maybe, I mean, it's also more realistic that Kirsten Dunst doesn't really get a redemption in this.
Mm-hmm.
It does play into those power dynamics. Eventually, Kevin Costner and American hero John Glenn learn to respect the work of Katherine Johnson. Meanwhile, Octavia Spencer has a whole subplot. So her character, Dorothy Vaughn, is trying to keep all of the women that are in the computation department afloat. She's trying to keep all of their jobs mm-hmm. because...
They're expendable because of who they are.
They are about to be replaced by a machine from IBM. Mm-hmm. That they kind of comedically play that they have this giant expensive machine that no one knows how to work and no one knows how to program.
Right.
So, and we mentioned last week about unpaid labor.
Yeah.
And what Octavia Spencer's character goes through in this is a good example of that. Because in order to keep her job, she literally, like, steals a book from the library, learns
to... But she doesn't steal, though, because it's her, you know, I pay taxes, it's my property. I love that line so much.
But she learns to code on her own, mm-hmm. And she teaches all of the other women in the office how to code.
Yeah.
So that they can all keep jobs, and, like, by the end of the film, they're in charge of running this giant IBM machine.
Yeah.
Because of
the unpaid time it took to learn it.
Right. And then finally rounding out the cast is the wonderful Janelle Monáe, who yeah. is, like, the younger, like, sassier of the three. And her whole arc is about...
Becoming an engineer.
Yeah, she wants to become an engineer. And she, like... And this is one of those things, like, where I mentioned the writing's not, like... The writing is a little on the nose. There's one moment, and it's even in the trailer, where... one of the white engineers old men that's working with her says something like, you know, if I were you, I would consider going to engineering school. And she turns back and says, if I were you, I would already be an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Something along those lines. Indicating that, like, it's not as easy for her to get into these schools.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not. She has to go to court for it.
Uh-huh. That scene in the courtroom is one of my favorites because it's an old white judge and you don't think he's going to listen. He's going to give her a hard time and say, that's cute, but, you know, what are you doing here? But she delivers this awesome monologue where she basically says, it has to start somewhere and I really can't get this degree unless I go to this class. And it was just, she, you know, basically butters him up by mentioning that this state was the first and all these things. And I want this to be the first for us.
For you.
Yeah.
For you. Because she is fully aware that he doesn't give a shit about her.
But it's like, and that was one of the best tips I learned as a Peace Corps volunteer. If you want to get somebody to do something for you, talk to them like a politician. Tell them what's in it for them.
That's true. And she plays him like a fiddle in that.
Yeah.
And says, you could be the judge that made this first thing happen. In the 60s, which were a time of firsts. Like, we're putting the first man into orbit.
Mm-hmm.
This
first could man
be
on the moon, yeah.
This could be, you could be a part of this.
Yeah.
And that's the... So he also, like, is... He basically has nothing to lose, but for him, he's like, oh, I'm staking my reputation on this. Bang, bang.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good moments there, and there's a lot of good examples of intersectionality, because it's not just that these women are women, and it's not just that they are black. It is that they are black women.
Mm-hmm.
And that threads throughout their social lives. Like, they do all of their flirting and courting through the church,
mm-hmm.
because they're in the South. Oh, man, there's another, like, the opening line of this movie, not the opening line, but the opening scene is... Their car breaks down, and a white cop pulls up, and we're all a little tense about it, and they convince the cop, because they're working at NASA, and the cop's like, well, we gotta beat them Russians,
I forgot about that
to
line.
Give them a ride home. But then, like, Janelle...
Ride to the office.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Ride to the office. And I should say, not a ride, a police escort.
Yeah.
Because they're like, we are not getting in that car.
Yeah.
Because it's the 1960s, and they know that if they get in that car, there's a good chance they don't get out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not exclusive to the 60s. But then Janelle Monáe has this line at the beginning. She's like, it's 1967, and we're three black women... driving down a dirt road in Georgia, following a cop car. And I'm just like, thank you for, you know, that exposition there, Janelle.
Just so you know, it was not 1967.
Wait, was it 1965? what did I get wrong? Okay, so it wasn't 67, it was...
1961. Or he orbited in 1962, but they were following the cop car in 1961.
Okay. Point is, and this is what I mean when I say that the writing's pretty on the nose. Like, she just gives that, like... exposition.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, it's a very good movie. It's a fun movie. It's like the kind of movie you can see being played in history classes.
Oh God, yeah.
That's like, this is like teacher is sick or teacher has a hangover movie.
Thanks, Mrs. Krabappel.
Yeah. But yeah, Hidden Figures is a good, like,
it's a good example of how, where we've come from and the fact that this is still a problem. That there are people who are very qualified, very talented, have the potential to change history, and they're being limited in their ability to do so simply because of how they look and harmful stereotypes associated with how they look.
So we talked about the wage gap before, but what we want to really get into is that these issues go just beyond numbers.
Yeah.
And it comes down to just a level of access, whether that's access to jobs, whether that's access to promotions.
Opportunities.
And whether those opportunities are given equally, which mm-hmm. they very clearly are not. Viola Davis, upon accepting her Oscar? Or her Golden, or her Golden Globe? It must have been her Emmy. Viola Davis, upon accepting her Emmy for How to Get Away with Murder, said, you cannot win awards for roles that are not there. Mm-hmm. So, and that's just one industry, one example of opportunities that are not given.
Yeah.
For a little bit more on this, we're going to go back to Carla Baptiste.
Carla Baptiste, I am the Career Center Manager at the Urban League of Philadelphia. The mission of the Urban League is to empower African Americans and other people of need in every aspect of life. So we are here within Career Services. We want to establish a level playing field for employers and employees. One of the things we try to do is to tell folks not to think of a position as one that's specifically only for men or only for women that are not of color or what have you. So think outside of the box and kind of like take a step out on faith and go into opportunities or in neighborhoods that you wouldn't have necessarily thought about. We get a lot of jobs here within the Career Center that are like, for instance, it's construction based or it may be like IT based and what have you. Very rarely do you find a lot of African American women in those particular fields. We get jobs, like recently we got a job posting for cable installers. We had some jobs that were geared towards some construction on the highways. And we really don't have a lot of women that are fitting that bill. So we're encouraging a lot more women to get into those fields. One of the ways that we're doing that is we recently just started an urban tech job training program here at the Urban League, and that is more of an IT focused training that we do in partnership with the Department of Labor, and we have had a really good success rate with enrollment, and predominantly a lot of African American women have taken advantage of that free training that we offer here for the IT type jobs. They're not aware that those options are out there. I think that it kind of goes back to, really and truly, it probably goes back to schools. A lot of high school students aren't aware that there are jobs out there within those particular fields, or they're not aware that those are things that they're able to do. We also have a youth component at the Urban League, and we have actually been going out to underserved schools and having them partner with an employer. So we have Comcast actually is a partner with one of the local high schools, and they're going out to those schools and talking to the students about job opportunities that's available in IT and in the telecommunications world. You have a lot of kids out there that are very tech savvy on their cell phones, on all kinds of gadgets, but they don't know that there are jobs in those particular fields for them, or they don't think that it's applicable to them. Recently, there was a job fair that was held here in the city, and somehow we'd gotten an invitation to it, and when we showed up, all of the participants, all of the employer participants were white, and all of the participants that came to the job fair were white. And we looked it up, and I don't know. I think we found out about it through someone else, kind of forwarded it to us. We weren't invited to this job fair. And when we got there, we were the only people of color that were there. So that particular job fair was never advertised to some of the nonprofits here in the city. I don't know if it was only sent out to specific organizations, but it was truly straight across the board. And I was very surprised because a job fair attracts everyone. There were no people of color at this particular job fair. There are a couple of other instances where I've gone into, you know, basic meetings and things like that, and I've only seen, you know, certain people represented. So I think sometimes there is a specific list, mail list, that goes out only to certain organizations. I'm not going to mention the name of the organization, but we have worked with a specific organization here in the city where we have sent some of the participants in a couple of our programs here who have college degrees. Some people have solid work experience in a particular field, and we've referred them to this company, and they actually hire them for entry level type of menial positions. And then we have actually seen where we actually took a visit to the office, and we've seen that predominantly in the office where the roles that we referred our clients to were being held by young white women that were a particular blonde hair, blue eye type of profile. And if they did hire someone that was of color, it was someone that was of mixed race that kind of fit the profile that they had within that office. And it was only like two women that were of mixed race within an office of about 30 people.
I'm Clint.
And I'm Jared.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Alcohollywood,
your source for cinebriation,
which you're not listening to right now because this is just a promo for a weekly podcast on all kinds of movies, new, old, good, bad.
Yeah, especially bad.
Plus, we invent a cocktail and a drinking game inspired by each film.
And sometimes we make jokes. Not this time, but sometimes.
Subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher and check out the whole shebang at alcohollywood.com.
And they're sending secret white emails. I made one mistake during my presentation and they lost all faith in me. You know, now I'm the black girl who fucked up. And white people at my job fuck up all the time. They didn't say shit to Caleb when he had the kids make those racist puppets. Where are those emails? I didn't get shit in my inbox.
Did you talk to Joanne about it?
No, then I look too sensitive. So fucking unfair.
I know, but hey, you just gotta work extra hard to prove him wrong.
Yeah. I'm about to plan the fuck out of beach day, though. I know that.
There you go.
Those kids, they not even ready for the ocean and shit.
Nope.
They about to be swimming with sharks. They about to be slap boxing with seals. I swear. Let these white people doubt me again. I'm going to throw a kid in their face.
So I saw the headhunter again today.
Oh, yeah? How'd that go?
It was all right. I mean, she said, even though I'm still getting interviews, I need to be more open to entry-level positions, but I'm not trying to go backwards, you know?
I mean, she sounds kind of right, though.
And we're back. That was a clip from Insecure, which is this really great show on HBO that you should totally watch. But that was the lead character, Issa, basically talking about how at her job she's planning a big project and she made one mistake, and because of one mistake, she's now being considered not trustworthy and people are really don't have any faith in her. And I mean, it's kind of what's remarkable about this scene is she's saying to her boyfriend, you know, where was this outrage when somebody else made a mistake? It seems like white people can make as many mistakes. And he was saying, well, at least you're aware of it, and now you just have to try harder. And it's like, well, why isn't it enough that she is who she is? Why can't she just mistake and, you know, be forgiven like the rest of us?
Right. It comes down to the idea that women have to work harder, and because they're not granted the luxury of mistakes.
Yeah, I guess. Freedom to fail.
The freedom to fail. We talked about this a little bit on my other show, Not Each Other, where we talked about the Fyre Festival, mm-hmm. And how the promoter of that had already failed in numerous businesses, and for some reason was still trusted to be able to put on a massive event.
Yeah.
Probably because he was white and a man and had money.
Mm-hmm.
In Insecure, the series follows Issa, a young black woman living in Inglewood, and her romantic issues with her boyfriend, her issues with her best friend Molly, and her struggles in her career. She works with a after-school program, like a sort of a boys and girls club specifically targeted at African-American children or inner-city children, mm-hmm. and sometimes that gets brought up as her like super white but well-meaning boss and white co-workers lean on her for their being their cultural guidance, uh-huh. I guess.
A.K.A. How do we reach out to black kids?
Yeah, exactly. She's suddenly the black girl. Like, there's a clip that goes around where one of the co-workers asks, like, Issa, what's on fleek mean? And Issa's like, I don't know what that is.
She walks away, I know what that means.
Of course I know what that means. Good, but she does. And that's another thing that we don't get into as much, but, like, when you are the only person of a certain gender or the only person of a certain race in an office environment, suddenly you are the black girl. Yeah. You are the ambassador of all black people. You are the ambassador of gays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so somehow we have to... That's what's always fun about the, like, but I have a black friend who said it was okay.
Yeah. Or like in Get Out, where the character says, like, my dad's not a racist. He keeps saying that if he, you know, Obama could have run for a third term, he would have voted for him.
Oh.
I love that so much. Like, I can't be racist. I voted for Barack Obama.
We may do Get Out in the future. We're going to have a guest on for that, because you and I are not qualified to have caught everything in that movie.
Yeah.
I caught a lot of it, but I don't think I caught everything.
Yeah.
Back to Issa, though. So the show was created for Issa by Issa. She was the... She had a web series called...
Adventures of Awkward Black Girl.
Yes. And a book. And that was enough for HBO to take a chance and work on her. By the way, you can tell from all the F-bombs, this is definitely HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch the show... All of the nudity.
Oh, yes.
This was just the one episode. Now, in this episode, Issa is planning a...
beach trip.
It's a beach trip. Like, they're trying to find something for the kids to do out in the world. Her inspiration for this was, in the previous episode, somebody mentioned that they'd grown up in Los Angeles all their life and somehow never seen, you know, gone to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And when she brings this up to her colleagues, they all think they're trying way too hard. One guy's like, we could do hip-hop Shakespeare, or we could go to an African-American museum.
Uh-huh.
The frustration on Issa's face is palpable, and she says, look, let's just take these kids to the beach.
Yeah.
And there are other little things, like, or the girls assume that they don't need sunscreen.
Oh my god, that part was hysterical. Like, I didn't think they would need sunscreen.
I'm yeah,
like,
the other co-workers figure that apparently black people don't sunburn.
Uh-huh.
In the very next episode... Well, let's back up, actually.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about being the ambassador of black people, there's a subplot with Issa's friend Molly,
mm-hmm.
who is a like mid-level lawyer mm-hmm. at a like at a pretty high prestigious firm.
Yeah.
And she has a new like summer intern,
something like that,
basically, who comes in, and they have a little moment where they look at each other like, hey, it's nice to see another black woman in this office.
Mm-hmm. You know, later, she overhears her talking loudly and is like, you know, she basically was being herself, the intern. She was talking like she would if she wasn't at the office, like they were at a bar or something. And Molly takes her aside and says, like, girl, you know how these white people are. You kind of, you got to switch it up a bit. So...
Which brings us into the idea of code switching. My God, you sounded so white just then. you sounded like a side character in Insecure.
Oh, jeez.
But code switching, yeah, and then she gets very angry. The intern does.
Yeah, like we'll, I don't. Yeah, well, we can. Let's play the clip.
Man, you ain't never lie. But for real, I was shadowing Meryl and Johnson on the Chin case, and I had to send myself to HR because Johnson is on.
Hey, Rashida. Hi.
Hey.
Can you come here for a second?
Oh, girl, of course. What? You better not eat my soup.
Hey, so, you know, I just wanted to
to check in to see how you were acclimating.
Oh, I'm good. Thanks.
Good, because, you know, I just want to make sure that no one gets the wrong impression of you.
Why would they? Mark said I was doing great.
Yeah, and you are. It's just, you know, sometimes you can be a little... Girl, you know how these white people are? If you want to be successful here, you gotta know when to switch it up a little bit.
I appreciate your feedback, but I didn't switch it up in my interview with the senior partners, and I didn't switch it up when I was named editor of the Law Review, so I don't think I need to switch it up now. But thank you so much.
So essentially, Molly is telling her intern, Rashida, to do a little bit of code switching, which is a term that has its origins in linguistics. Basically, it means, like, if you're bilingual, swapping quickly from one language to another.
Right.
It's something that, culturally, we all kind of do. Any social animal does this. You just understand, if you exist in a society, that there are certain roles you have to play in certain times in order to function with that. Ask any teenager what they did this weekend, and they will change their answer depending on whether their parents are asking or their friends are asking.
Right.
If you're like a child of divorced parents, you'll understand that you can act one way at one house and you act one way at a different house. And you learn very quickly how to adapt that. Funny story from the wild, animal behavior is that puffins, who are also extremely social animals, have a version of code switching. And they demonstrated this by placing some dummies, like little stuffed puffins, on poles onto some islands on the East Coast. They were trying to get these islands repopulated with puffins. And puffins showed up, and they looked at these stuffed puffins that are sitting on a post, which looked like they were had one leg. And puffins, trying to fit in, lifted up one leg and just figured, oh, apparently on these islands we stand on one leg.
I love how while we're recording this you're actually lifting one
leg. I'm actually lifting my leg for some reason.
He's got a drive for authenticity, folks. But yeah, so you're basically being one way with one group of people and then being another way with another group of people.
The purpose of the puffin story was not to compare people to puffins, but
how we adapt based on where we are.
Any social animal is programmed to do this.
Yeah.
But for African Americans, for people of color, it's a completely different thing where in order to succeed, they feel like they have to essentially be whiter.
And there's actually a great intro to an episode of Blackish where, what's his name? The guy that plays the dad.
Anthony Anderson.
Anthony Anderson. So the dad, Anthony Anderson, is narrating the episode. And you see footage of Barack Obama shaking hands with some guys at a basketball event. And he's like, now, Barack Obama, this guy knew how to switch. And you see him shaking hands and, you know, being cordial with, you know, the white players that he's shaking hands with. Suddenly, black guy comes up, you know, we have a handshake and we bring it in for a hug. Like, he knows how to switch off from, I'm talking to my white colleagues, to I'm talking to somebody from my community. And that was a monumental moment for me, because I'm just like, oh my god, I guess that is something that has to happen.
Yeah, it's...
If you want to fit in.
By the way, you ever see, like, two people, one person goes in for, like, a handshake, and the other person goes in for, like, a fist bump or whatnot.
And then there's, like, cupping of the hands.
And it's super awkward, but it's always way more awkward if there's a racial difference between the two people.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about here, essentially. And that's what we talk about when we say that, like, Issa's white colleagues are trying way too hard. Now, this is episode 3 of Insecure that we're talking about. In the very next episode, Issa's white boss Molly's white boss asks her to have the conversation with Rashida that she just tried to have in the clip that we...
Right.
So then Molly goes on a date and she complains about being
the black translator. Yeah.
Right. The ambassador to black people, as we just mentioned.
Yeah.
So, and that's
such a good series. I love what they try to do with it. It's great.
And yeah, a lot of the stuff that gets brought up is stuff that just would not occur naturally to white people like you and I.
Yeah.
Well,
the other thing that we were talking about before we started recording is, isn't it amusing with so many of these shows where we have black characters, they are the best in their fields, like the best attorney, the best doctor, you know, Claire Huxtable and Cliff Huxtable.
Right.
In this series, Molly is one of the best attorneys.
Well, she's a mid-tier attorney. Like, no one's going to say she doesn't work hard, but she's not, like, partner.
Right.
Yeah. And I do think that, yeah, that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about Insecure is that, yeah, you have your Claire Huxtables on Black-ish. Bo is a, like, the top neurosurgeon. And it's awesome. It's awesome that they think to put these women in these roles to, like, say that this is something that can be done. But it also almost feels like overcompensation to a certain point.
Like, why can't we see somebody who's going, like a retail employee who's African-American? Why can't we see someone walking aimlessly through the job desert trying to figure out who they are?
Which, for the record, NBC's Superstore is a pretty good example of that. Yeah. Like, pretty diverse cast there. If Lena Dunham and her white friends are allowed 6 seasons to wander aimlessly through Brooklyn and never really accomplish anything, that same luxury should also be afforded to our characters of color. And I think Issa and Insecure are a good example of that, because she's like, she likes her job. Mm-hmm. It's not wonderful. She's got like a side thing she wants to do. And Molly does like her job, but she's not the top of that firm.
Right.
She's not the highest paid employee, as we learn in the most recent episode, where Molly gets to see a look at her white male co-worker's paycheck.
Yeah, like $6,000, and she's just like, oh, man.
By the way, who still gets paper paychecks?
Like, someone who's obviously very careless.
Yeah, like, we have direct deposit probably just to avoid things like this happening.
Yeah.
But in the most recent episode, Molly gets to look at Travis, her white male co-worker's paycheck, sees that it's a much higher than hers, and is pretty pissed about that. Now, Travis is completely oblivious.
Mm-hmm.
He has no idea. And later on, they're at a going-away party for their boss, the same white boss I just mentioned a minute ago, who asked Issa... I'm sorry, I keep saying...
Yes, Molly.
Who asked Molly to have that conversation. And he says something along the lines of, oh yeah, they are sending her away because she couldn't cut it. Heard she was stressed out. You know, if she was unhappy, she should have said something. It sounds super douchey when he says it.
But that's what really happens.
Molly's response is like, yeah, because when a woman opens her mouth, everybody just automatically listens. And
right.
He kind of puts him in his place. He's just kind of taken aback and does like an awkward chuckle for it. It's a great scene because it's a very like natural response. And you can tell this guy who's being a bit of a douche doesn't realize what a douche he's being. And he's not saying this out of like a place of malice. He's just saying it out of a place of complete lack of understanding.
Right.
Now, would he understand if it was brought to his attention? Would he make any attempt to change? Probably not, and that's what makes him a douchebag. But I don't necessarily... No, I'm going to say he's a douchebag. He's a douchebag. I feel safe just saying he's a douchebag.
Do it.
Ignorance of the law is no excuse, I guess, in this case.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That's Insecure.
So that's Insecure. Specifically, we talked about Episode 3, Season 1, written by Dana Lynn North, directed by Melina Mazzucas. Episode 4, Season 1, written by Laura Cottrell and directed by Kevin Bray. And Season 2, Episode 1, written by Issa Rae, directed by, again, Melina Mazzucas. So that was Insecure. We've got one other film on the docket, and I'm really glad that we get to talk about this.
Yeah.
This is a independent film from 2014 that I don't think a whole lot of people saw. I think I just found it when it was on TV one day. But it's written and directed by a man named Anthony Lucero. Lucero? I'm not sure.
It's all good.
And it is called East Side Sushi. East Side Sushi tells the story of a single mom named Juana, played by a woman named Diana Elizabeth Torres, who runs a fruit cart in Oakland with her father.
Mm-hmm.
And when that job gets a little bit too dangerous, she starts to look for a more steady job in a kitchen. And she's...
Leads her to a sushi bar.
Yeah, she winds up working at a sushi bar. She's explained that before she's worked at a lot of restaurants, mostly Mexican and some Italian, but now she's in a totally different cultural experience. And as she works backstage in the kitchen and learns more about the food and the culture, she begins to really love sushi, and she wants to start working and studying to become a sushi chef.
But
dun
dun dun.
And there's a sushi chef that works there named Aki. Mm-hmm. Named Aki, who is helping her and believes in her, but the owner of the owner of the restaurant, Mr. Yoshida, is not happy with the idea for two reasons. Number one, because she's a woman, right. And number two, because she's not Japanese. Mm. Even though some of the other sushi chefs are not Japanese either.
They're Korean.
I think one is Chinese, but they look Japanese enough for the white paying customers to be quote unquote authentic.
Mm-hmm. In America, the idea is that we basically, as everybody has the same features, it'll fool the Americans. They'll think they're all the same.
In fact, as far as I can tell, there's only one major white character in this movie who's mm-hmm. only in one scene, but that's the rich yuppie cowboy looking guy who comes to the restaurant when Juana is working up front mm-hmm. and complains that he was worried about a lack of authenticity. So that scene is just there just to highlight that it's not really Mr. Yoshida. He's trying to appease the white customers and the white gaze, I suppose.
It's all about that white gaze, man.
G-A-Z-E.
Mm-hmm. There is one other portion, and that's at the end with the competition. There is a white MC.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I'd forgotten about that character. But that's another thing. At the end of this movie, Juana goes into, San Francisco's Best Sushi Chef competition. And they are surprised by her presence there for the aforementioned reasons. She enters using just her initial.
Yeah, Juana would give her away.
Right. I don't think her name was... I don't remember her last name, but it wasn't anything stereotypically Hispanic. It wasn't mm-hmm. Diaz or anything. She just goes by Jay.
Yeah.
And when she arrives at the studio, they're very surprised to see...
Oh, you're the contestant.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, and even... There's even another layer in that scene when she walks in. They start talking to her dad. And then they're like, oh, you're the contestant. The woman in this... Which is funny because, for... moms are typically the first person... they're the introduction to cooking in many families. So it's kind of funny that... In a competition, they would automatically assume that it's the guy instead of, women can cook too, guys.
because once something becomes professional and high level, we default it to men.
Yes.
Cooking is a very weird thing in that regard, mm-hmm. Where food preparation is considered women's work unless under specific circumstances, like running the grill, or anytime when it gets up to, the highest levels, the highest echelons. Mm-hmm. Then they are completely male-dominated. Just like we mentioned with computing, once something becomes high-paying and quote-unquote prestigious, then it becomes incredibly male-dominated.
Yeah.
It's such a weird thing. There's also a moment in that scene where she enters the competition and she enters the studio that she attempts to speak Japanese to the, PA. There's a young Asian woman... who is the production assistant, mm-hmm. and they attempt to speak a little bit of Japanese, and the woman says, "I'm not Japanese, but neither are you, so hey."
I forgot about that part.
It's a good little gag.
Well, I'm looking at my notes, and there was a line, one of the other contestants or one of their helpers was saying, "Oh, I didn't realize this was a baking competition," as soon as Juana walks onto the set getting ready to do her thing.
Yeah, there's lots of little digs at that, And then, but this also has the racial factor to it.
Yeah.
Juana, or Diana Torres, the actress, doesn't get a whole lot of big monologues in this movie, mm-hmm. which I like. I think she gets, two. And when she has the big confrontation with Mr. Yoshida, she observes that there are Hispanics working in the back of every kitchen in this city, mm-hmm. but that's where they are. They're in the back.
Yeah, they can't get up to the front.
And that's one of her sticking points. And it's this, cross-cultural dynamic issue that has almost nothing to do with white people.
Yeah.
Except, in the background radiation, mm-hmm. the real reasoning. It's a super subtle thing. And that's what I like about this movie, is it's well-performed.
Yeah.
It's authentic. There's mm-hmm. lots of little touches that I enjoy.
And, it knows what it is. It knows it's not trying to be an Academy Award winner. It's not, making grand gestures. It's just trying to tell a really good story in a way that is unexpected. And I think the unexpected nature of this movie is what makes it. Like, you're thinking it's going to end this way, or, oh, this character is going to open up her own restaurant or something like that. It's like, no, she's going to challenge another culture and its own norms.
Yeah, it takes a lot of directions. It takes a lot of points where, like, we've seen this movie before, and yeah. But it doesn't quite hit it exactly. It kind of hits it just from a side angle.
Yeah.
One thing I appreciate is her relationship with the chef Aki.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, it's kind of hinted.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah, it's hinted that they're dating, mm-hmm. maybe. Like, he probably has a crush on her.
Yeah.
At the very least. But it's never, like, dragged out.
Mm-hmm.
They go on, I guess, what could be considered a date in one scene. Again, it kind of just seems like two colleagues from work.
Yeah.
It could have gone either way, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that. A lesser film would have made the romance, the romantic subplot, a huge... It would be that. It would be exactly that, a subplot.
Yeah.
And this movie doesn't need that. It's telling one story. It's the story of Juana, her quest to become a sushi chef. Another thing that a lesser movie would have done is they would have delved really deep into, like, the kid.
Mm-hmm.
We don't learn a whole lot about Juana's daughter in this. Like, she gets a few cute scenes,
yeah.
But that she's the kid. We don't need to have, like, the kid to have cancer or something.
Well, and while you're saying that, it reminds me of other movies where the woman who's working in the relationship has to make a choice. And we'll probably get into this when we talk about pregnancy portrayed in film and pop culture and TV. But we don't get a scene where we're at the principal's office and the principal's like, you know, I feel like your daughter is not doing as well in school because you're not around anymore and she needs, you know, two parental figures in her life and something like that. So it's a win-win for everybody, even though Juana has to overcome so many of these obstacles to prove that she is a brilliant chef and is deserving of this opportunity. She's not really punished for it. Like, if you think of movies like The Devil Wears Prada, where Andy loses her boyfriend, her friends start to leave her, she loses, you know, her alliances with people around her, like Emily Blunt's character. But in this movie, there are no negative repercussions for a woman going after her career, and I just think that's super refreshing.
Yeah, the closest that it comes is, like, conflicts between her and her dad.
Yes.
In fact, so yeah, she has two real conflicts, and they're both with older men.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So there's conflicts with her and her dad. And that's her other big scene, is where she has to tell her father, look, I've done everything I can to support you and support my daughter. Why can't I just do this for me? Why can't you step it up in the, like, co-parenting department and help me out here, yeah, a little bit? And he does come around, which is nice. And I love the guy playing the father.
Yeah.
His name is Rodrigo Duarte Clark, and I think he only has one other acting credit. Like... And yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this on the show is that I want to promote this and I want everybody involved who did a great job to have more things coming for them. I think that they deserve to have extra acting credits and extra directing credits. I really want to see more from this crew.
Yeah, because they're newcomers. Everybody has like one or two credits to their name, at least on the Internet Movie Database.
Right, take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about this script, and we mentioned how it's subtle,
yeah,
but there are little payoffs. At the very beginning of the movie, there's a argument between Juana and her father,
mm-hmm,
over how to prepare the fruit salads that they're selling at their cart.
Yeah.
And he wants to just buy like a squeezed bottle of lime juice,
mm-hmm,
and she points out that no, it's so much better with the lime, like a freshly squeezed lime, just, yeah, that little... And it lets you know that she's the kind of person who wants to go in and put in that extra bit of work to get the highest quality. And that pays off later, after she's working at the kitchen, they're like at a street fair, they go to another fruit cart, and that fruit cart uses the squeezed lime, and she just looks on with disgust.
Like, yeah, like, how could you?
She's offended, because for her, this is like art, this is work.
And yeah.
So she does the homework. We mentioned unpaid labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Juana does the homework at her house.
Yeah, so she puts in that unpaid time in order to get better at her craft. And I like that those little subtle character descriptions that were offered, like using a lime, taking her work home with her, like these all build character to show that this person is meticulous, they have a great attention to detail, and they want the best ingredients. They're like, who could be more deserving than that to be a sushi chef, which is something that requires fresh ingredients and the most perfect ingredients as well.
By the way, if you do watch this movie, you should order some takeout and have something ready for
I made
you.
The mistake of not eating anything while I think I had dinner maybe an hour before I watched this. I was miserable. I'm like, I want food, but I'm full.
The food photography in this movie is gorgeous. The direction in this film is okay, but that food photography is amazing, and it really like drives home this menu-perfect ideals.
Yeah.
And it kind of hits what we see that Juana is striving for. Like, it's enticing. You look at that and you go, oh, yeah, I can understand why you would put in the work to create that. You should be very proud of yourself, fictional character. I'm proud of you.
Well, the music was also worth noting because it reminded me a lot of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Like, there's drums and sounds of,
Yeah,
the music was very, it was more like a martial arts journey film than it was a culinary coming of age story.
That's an excellent observation.
Yeah.
Especially during that, like, last competition scene where it just completely switches styles and now we're basically watching an episode of Iron Chef.
Yeah.
And they got fairly creative with that. So we're watching it as if we were watching this show on television or if we were watching it on our iPad in the sushi restaurant, which Aki is doing.
Yeah.
And we watch it like it's on the Food Network until the commercial break, and then we go backstage for a little bit. And it's just a nice... It's a nice touch that they didn't have to do. But it enhances that little bit in there. Again, it's this authenticity. This is a very authentic movie.
Yeah. Well, and spoiler alert, I also really like that she doesn't win the competition.
Yep. We... yeah.
Well, because I feel like it's a movie that is aware of what it is. It knows what its limitations are. But again, this is a movie that's been all about upending expectations, like putting a Hispanic woman in a sushi chef, in a sushi restaurant, having a romantic interest that isn't really that obvious. Like, we don't see an actual romantic relationship out of it. And then we have...
She doesn't get the prize in the end. She's not...
Yeah, and she doesn't... It just totally upends that formula. Like, there's a specific formula that's been in place of somebody, you know, who wants to take a chance. They're rewarded for it. They may have some setbacks. People don't believe that they can do it, but then they do it, and it's amazing, and they save the day. She proves herself, but she doesn't do it in the way... That proof doesn't come in the form that we were led to expect that it would. Like, you're expecting she'll win the competition, Mr. Yoshida will give her the job... So on and so forth, and it doesn't happen that way. So I won't tell you if he gives her a job or not. I will not spoil that for you, but you should still go see it.
I feel like that's the smaller of the two spoilers, but okay.
Yeah.
I will say, though, like, what Juana made in the final competition looked a hell of a lot better than what actually won.
Yeah.
That one, it was, like, style over substance, but I really want to eat the sushi that Juana makes.
Yeah.
So if you're a chef and you watch this movie on our recommendation... That's your assignment. You get to send something to us.
Yeah, let us know what you think and also send us food. But that you actually bring up a really good point because then it also points to the sexism that she's been trying to overcome as well. So maybe she lost because they're just like, this is too big of a suspension of our system of belief. We can't believe that a woman who's not Japanese and who is not male... you know, made this dish, like, we have to give the award to a Japanese man.
Possibly. And it, again, it leaves it ambiguous. So the dish that does win is this very elaborate, intricate, very stylish piece of work with a whole lot of things going on. I think he makes, like, a Golden Gate Bridge out of carrots or something like that. It looks very cool, but compared to Juana's Japanese-Mexican fusion that she makes, I can't imagine it tastes anywhere near as good. Because he makes what is essentially a traditional dish, but with a whole lot of style and flair to it. And she makes something
with
completely
substance.
New.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, East Side Sushi, the Mexican title is Sushi a la Mexicana. This is, I'm hesitant to call it a foreign, it's not a foreign film, it was U.S.
It's
produced.
Just an independent film.
It's an independent film, and it's... spoken in three different languages. English, Spanish, and Japanese are all used throughout.
Yeah.
So you'll do some reading, but it won't matter because you'll also be drooling over some food.
Mm-hmm.
Alright, so that is East Side Sushi. You can find it sometimes on HBO. I think you can get it through most of your digital rental services. That is where you can find it. Where can we find you, Marta?
You can find me wherever there's good pizza, speaking of food. But more specifically, if you want to find me online, I'm on Facebook, Marta from Philly. I'm also on Twitter at Marta Russick. That's R-U-S-E-K. And you can also visit my website, martarussick.com.
You can find me at Schneid Remarks. That's S-C-H-N-E-I-D Remarks. You can read my writing about movies with a whole bunch of other talented people on frontrowcentral.com. And you can listen to my other podcast, Not Each Other, on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and the podcast catcher of your choice. If you do wind up seeing East Side Sushi on our recommendation, or you see any of the films on our recommendation, or you think we're completely wrong about these films, or you want to call us out for being completely wrong about anything that we've said, just get in touch with us. You can email us, politicaltheaterpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet at us, at polytheatercast, that's P-O-L-I theatercast. And we're on Facebook, facebook.com/politicaltheaterpodcast. If you like us, please remember to rate us, review us, share it with your friends, help other people discover the podcast, and that helps us a lot. We appreciate all of it, and we appreciate you. This is Political Theater. Thank you for joining us. Let's play you out.
Yeah.